everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Jessie Breslau. She is the co-founder and product manager at foodshed.io. And I'll tell you more about Foodshed when she comes on in a little bit. But first, I want to go over some things going on in the news and share with you some things going on in the New York area that you may be interested in participating in, and of course share my weekly recipe with you. So first off, I just want to share with you that I was reading a article recently, and I know it's been discussed many times, and it's been debated and been put out as being not accurate, but there's more and more research being done on the connection of vaccinations and aluminum in the brain. And, you know, I'm really not a scientist, and I'm not going to go into discussing it, but I think it's really important that we look at, and all of us look at, the research that's being done. If you just Google it, I did that right before the show just to see what else I was finding. And if you, if you Google aluminum in vaccines and autism, you'll see so many different studies, you know, and there's people that are trying to debunk the research, but there's a lot of research being done outside of the U.S. from independent research people, and you just have to take a step back and take a look at how many vaccinations our kids are getting these days. I mean, when my kids were little, you know, they got 4, 5, 6 vaccinations. I did many of them, but not all of them, you know, but I kind of researched and made my decision. Now it's being suggested that kids get, you know, over 30 vaccinations. And if not all of them have aluminum in them, and, you know, it's crossing over into the brain. And there's a real question here. And I just, you know, you have to look at what has changed when you see a society all of a sudden with an epidemic of a problem where, you know, 1 in 36 kids being born in the U.S. right now have autism, and they say 1 out of 2 boys by 2050, 1 out of 2 boys being born in the U.S. will have autism. I mean, that's just shocking, and, you know, what would happen to our society if that really panned out? So I think we just need to really start being advocates for ourselves and take things into our own hands and really do our own research. You always have to look at who's behind the research that we look at. You know, we've been debating this issue with GMOs for years now, and you have to realize that the research universities that are doing the research are being funded by the biotech companies and the companies that would be dramatically hurt by many of the studies if they came out with negative findings. So what's being supported and funded is in question, and also once they have the results of research, it is up to them as to what gets published. So you really need to look at that. And the internet is a wonderful place because you can find things on there that you otherwise wouldn't have access to. But you also have to look really hard at who's funding it and follow the money trail, because that really tells you so much. This weekend on Saturday is the March for Science rally that is taking place in New York City. It's also taking place in Washington, D.C., which is the main one. But it's been a year already since the March of Science rally happened last year. And it is a huge, huge protest to really try to bring science back into our government. I mean, we have a Environmental Protection Agency and a leader of that agency, Scott Pruitt, who denies science and is a climate denier and doesn't believe what 95% of most scientists believe. And as a result, the bills that they are trying to reverse for clean air, clean water, protecting lands, I mean, they're just turning everything around, all this work that Obama did to try to help and other presence before him to protect our land and water and air and to reverse the smog that we had 20 years ago. I mean, it's so much better, and the Hudson River is so much better. I mean, you know, things have moved in the right direction, and we have these politicians that are trying to just return everything to the way it was and reverse standards that are trying to clean up our environment in the name of business and money. So we really need to all stand up for that. And this weekend at the March of Science is an opportunity to do that. And you can just Google March of Science, go to their .com, their Facebook page as well, and you'll find other locations of where there's rallies going on. There's one out in Riverhead. There's another one on Long Island. So they're all over the country. So check out March for Science and consider participating. However, there's always other things going on at the same time. Tonight, actually, there's a rally for peace at the Cimna Arts Center, which is our local arts cinema in Huntington. And peace activist Cindy Sheehan will be there, as well as a Long Island activist, Gail Payne. And they're going to do a short presentation about war and its huge impact on the environment. And with our current administration, who seems to have no problem threatening war and bombs and what have you, this might be a nice time to come together with others that would like to push for peace. Also this weekend, in addition to the March for Science, on Saturday, the SUNY Farmingdale is having their 6th annual Sustainable Garden Conference. And that's always a wonderful opportunity to come out and hear tips on how to grow, how to become more sustainable. They have a wonderful teaching garden at the university, a really beautiful garden where they plant local indigenous crops along with other native plants, and just really have a beautiful, beautiful garden there. And so there will be people speaking all day long. So check out the 6th Sustainable Garden Conference at SUNY Farmingdale. Also on April 14th, Diet and Dementia, there's a class being done with that from Lori Courage, who was my guest last week, actually 2 weeks ago. She will be teaching Diet and Dementia, and it's really about plant-based eating and how that can heal you and prevent Alzheimer's disease. So that's in Port Washington on April 14th. On April 19th, the Long Island Food Coalition, which I am a part of, along with Hofstra University and the Long Island Land Alliance, we are sponsoring a conference at Hofstra called the State of Long Island Local Suburban Agriculture and Where Do We Grow From Here. And Mark Winnie, who was also a guest on my show a few weeks ago, he wrote the book Stand Together or Starve Alone. He will be the keynote speaker, and he's talking about the need for us all in our grassroots movements to figure out ways of finding the common ground and working together. Right now, so many of these grassroots organizations all doing good things, but we're working in our own little silos and repeating things and not making the headway that we would make if we all pulled our resources and worked together. So I'm really looking forward to his talk at Hofstra on Thursday, April 19th. You can register. It's a free conference, but you do need to register. So you can find the link on my website for all of these things, or you can go to the Hofstra University events website and find it there. There's a screening of a film called Before the Flood, and that's going to be taking place at the Half Hollow Hills Community Library on Thursday evening after our conference. So you might be interested in that. The Long Island Food Council is also having a conference on Friday, April 20th at the Hotel Indigo in Riverhead. And the keynote speaker will be Randy Dresner, who is the executive director of Island Harvest Food Bank. And also the Suffolk County executive Steve Ballone will be there. And they'll be having panel discussions. There will be lots of, you know, different food being offered there and great discussion. So check that out. It's from 10 to 1 in Riverhead. April 21st, Growing to Give is a forum for gardeners, and that's taking place at St. Francis Episcopal Church out in Belmore. And then April 21st is, actually April 22nd is Earth Day, and there's many different Earth Day events going on. The Peconic Land Trust is having an Earth Day walk the day before on April 21st, and the New York Society of Ethical Culture is having an Earth Day event as well at Project Farmhouse. Oh, no, not Project Farmhouse. I'm sorry. You'll have to find that on my website. I'm actually not sure where that's taking place. But then April 23rd is a big rally up in Albany, and there's lots of buses going from Long Island and from the whole New York City region, as well as across the state. So if you live in New York, you want to find yourself in Albany on Monday, April 23rd, to let Governor Cuomo know that we want him to walk the walk that he talks. Because he talks about environmentalism, he talks about sustainability, and yet he's not doing enough. 2 years ago, he promised us an impact risk assessment on what it would be like to put a pipeline right next to the nuclear power plant Indian Point. And as to this date, he has not given us that risk assessment yet. And plans for this pipeline are still moving forward, and it's just ridiculous. We need to close the nuclear power plant, and we need to do away with these pipelines. We need to stop transporting the fracked gas and dirty wastewater through our cities in New York. You know, years ago he opposed fracking in New York State, yet he's still letting us import all the dirty waste and gas from that. And you know, we know from history, pipelines do burst, they do explode, railroad cars do tumble over and have accidents, and we just can't afford these kind of mishaps. So we need to let Governor Cuomo know how we feel. So if you take a bus from Long Island, I will be feeding our bus, leaving from Christopher Morley. So check that out and sign up. On April 24th, there's a film screening about James Beard, the America's first foodie. And Charles Plackin, who runs the sustainability program up at Hunter College, he will be doing the introductions. And there will be refreshments served. And this will be taking place at Hunter College on April 24th, beginning at 5:30. There's a sheep shearing festival up at Stone Barns, which I believe is sold out, but you might want to try to see if you can get a ticket if you have kids that might be interested. It's really an amazing thing to see sheep being sheared. And April 30th at Project Farmhouse, there's a screening of Farmers for America. And I bought my tickets for that already. They're very reasonable, and it should be really a great screening, and there's a talk afterwards. Lindsay Lusser-Schutt, who has been a guest on my show, and she is one of the founders of the National Young Farmers Coalition. She'll be there as part of a panel discussion. So that starts at 6 o'clock, and they also will be providing light refreshments. So hope to see you at Project Farmhouse. There's so many other things on my website coming up that I really suggest you just check out my website and see the events there, because it's, you know, every week I spend a lot of time really collating events from all different sites that I get in my news feed, and it's really a very comprehensive list of things going on in the New York area. So you'll want to check those out. And then I want to share with you my weekly recipe now. And this week, it's a three-bean tortilla soup. I have lots of great recipes on my website, so you should check those out. This soup has no oil in it, you know, and very minimal salt. You can leave the salt out if you're on a oil-free, salt-free diet. But I have friends that have really been reducing the oil in their diet, and that's something good for all of us to think about. So instead of sautéing the vegetables ahead of time, in oil, I just caramelize them with water, which is a really nice thing to do. And I'm starting to do that more as part of my Healthy Teachers program. I'm working with Whole Kids Foundation and teaching classes at schools. And that promotes a no oil and no salt diet, plant-based, of course. So anyway, in keeping with that, this three-bean tortilla soup is just fantastic. So it serves about 8 people, and it comes together very quickly. I used canned beans, and when I use canned beans, I like to use Eden organic beans because they cook their beans with kombu, which really helps in the digestion and keeps the beans from being quite so gassy. So if you want to splurge for Eden, they're a little bit more money, but that's why. They're really worth it. But otherwise, you do want to just use organic beans. So I use 2 cans of organic black beans, 1 can of organic red kidney beans, 1 can of organic cannellini beans, 6 cups of vegetable broth, and you want to make sure the vegetable broth you use is either homemade or one that does not have oil in it if you want to keep this oil-free, 8 cloves of garlic, 2 onions chopped, 2 red peppers chopped, 1 jalapeno pepper, 1 tablespoon chili powder, 1 teaspoon cumin, 1 teaspoon unsweetened cocoa powder, and you can actually go up, you know, add a little bit more of that, and you can decide that by tasting it at the end if you wanted to add more cocoa powder. 1/2 teaspoon oregano, 1 teaspoon dried chipotle chili pepper powder, 1 can of diced fire-roasted tomatoes with chili peppers, and I get those from Trader Joe's. They're great. 1/2 teaspoon of salt, and like I said, if you are on a salt-free diet, you can easily leave that out. 6 corn tortillas that I cut into 1/2-inch strips, and I have a new air fryer that I was talking with all of you about a few weeks ago, and I've been having fun with that. So I cooked the corn tortillas in an air fryer because I was figuring that I'm making this corn, this three-bean tortilla soup, and if I wanted to put tortilla chips in it, most tortilla chips have oil. So I made my own with really fresh corn tortillas and just cooked them up in the air fryer, and they came out really crispy and delicious. 1 red onion chopped small for garnish, 1 avocado cubed for garnish, 1/2 cup of cilantro that I had added to the soup plus a little more for garnish, and 2 limes that I cut into wedges. And so I started by sautéing the chopped onion in a soup pot with 1 tablespoon of water. And then you just keep watching it, and you're sautéing the onion in water instead of oil. And as it starts to brown, you can add another tablespoon of water, and you do that as much as you need to caramelize the onions. And you're going to cook those for 5 minutes or so until they start getting caramelized and brown. Then you're going to add the peppers and the garlic and continue sautéing in the same method. Instead of adding oil, you're just going to add 1 tablespoon of water at a time and sauté that. Then you're going to drain the beans and add those to the pot. Add the vegetable broth or water if you don't have any. Fire-roasted tomatoes and all the spices. Add the cocoa. And stir that up. Let that cook for a little bit. And then I partially pureed the soup. I wanted to leave some beans whole, but I also wanted to give the broth a thicker texture. So I partially pureed the soup using a handheld immersion blender that I just put right into the pot and blended it up a little bit. And then you taste it for the spices, adjusting it to your taste. If you like it a little spicier, you can add a little bit more chili powder or chipotle pepper. And then I garnished each bowl with the fried tortilla, the crispy tortilla strips, some chopped red onion, some avocado, and some cilantro. And I served it with a lime wedge on the side. And it was just delicious. And it really did come together that quickly. So I do hope you make it. And, of course, as I've said before, I love feedback from all of you. So if you make it, please let me know how you like it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Jessie Breslau. She's the co-founder and project manager at foodshed.io. And Foodshed is an organization connecting sustainable producers to local wholesale markets. And Jessie works to help make that happen. And their mission is to improve access for farmers and for consumers to local food by supporting the good food movement and keeping dollars in the local economy. And Jessie's experience, she's worked on urban and rural farms in the United States and abroad, and she brings that information with her to Food Shed and has really been working to expand that. And she is also she's also working on an urban farm called Feedback Farm in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and is the farm manager there. So, Jessie, are you with me?
I am. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So, before we get started with Food Shed, I'd love to just hear a little bit about your own background and how you got involved with food and farming and, you know, and a little bit about where you worked abroad and that kind of thing.
Sure. So I actually grew up in New York City, and growing up, I didn't really know or care that much about the food that I was eating. And I actually went to college in Ithaca, and it wasn't until I got to college that I realized how problematic it was that I had never known or cared about the food that I was eating, but also that that was never questioned. And so I originally went into college to study environmental science, and I took some courses that were related to sustainable agriculture and the food system, and I realized that I just had to be studying this and I had to be involved in this. And I think I realized that being a farmer is maybe the most important profession that someone could have. And so, yeah, it was in my first year of college that I switched my major and I started studying agriculture. And then I, you know, had the academic experience, but I also wanted to follow that up with on-the-ground practical farming experience. And so I worked, the first farm I worked on was right outside of Watkins Glen, which is about like a 40-minute drive north of Ithaca, which was an organic CSA farm. And then I worked on an urban farm in Baltimore. And then I have also worked at a hydroponic farm in New York City. And I worked at a bunch of organic and biodynamic farms all over Colombia.
Colombia, South America.
The country. Colombia and South America. I was traveling. I spent about 6 months there traveling. I was mostly near Bogota, but I also went further north in the country and was working on a variety of farms, all that were practicing organic and biodynamic farming practices.
Mm. Wow. And over how long a period did you do all of that?
In Colombia, I was there for about 6 months, and I went to three different farms. And the rest of the times that I spent working on farms were summers between cool. college, and then I worked for about 6 months at a hydroponic farm, an indoor hydroponic farm in the financial district in New York City, actually.
Mm-hmm. At some point, I'd love to, I don't want to take the time right this minute, but I would love to hear your opinion on hydroponics. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of the whole discussion amongst organic farmers as to whether hydroponics should be. Actually, I'm going to just ask you now. What's your opinion? Whether hydroponic, what's your thought on it? You know, as to whether hydroponics should qualify as organic or needs its own labeling? You know, having, you know, I guess the question or the feeling amongst organic farmers is that organic is about the soil, and if you don't have soil, hydroponic can't really be organic. What is your thoughts on that?
I mean, I feel kind of torn. I think that I do agree with that to an extent, and I also think that we need to move away from organic being the only label that means something. I am not involved in hydroponic growing right now, but I know a lot of people who are, and I think that it can be a really great and safe and healthy practice, and I don't think that it necessarily has to be labeled organic for people to feel the same way and to feel the same sort of security that they feel about organic soil-grown produce.
Mm-hmm. Amongst hydroponic growers, is there a variety of what they're feeding the plants so that some hydroponics are more organic-based than others?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? My phone made a
sure
amount.
My question is, you know, what do they feed the hydroponic plants, and is there a variety amongst hydroponic growers where, you know, a big hydroponic commercially grown setup might give them chemicals, you know, for as part of their feeding process, where a smaller hydroponic person might be doing it more organically, sustainably. Is there a variety amongst hydroponics in that range?
There is. I'm not an expert in hydroponic growing, but there is a variety of fertilizers and nutrients that different growers can use, and there are organic certified nutrients that these growers can use, and they put them into their water supply usually.
Right. And so then there's others that don't use organic feeding, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, it's the same as any agricultural farming practice. It's up to the discretion of the grower. And so the hydroponic grower can use, you know, exclusively organic growing materials, or they could, you know, they could choose to not.
Right. So I just want to put it out there to my listeners that all hydroponics are not equal.
Right.
Correct?
Correct.
Okay. So let's talk about Food Shed. So how did you come up with the idea of Food Shed, and how did Food Shed come to be? And can you tell us a little bit about Food Shed?
Sure. So Food Shed came to be actually out of Feedback Farms, the farm in Bushwick that you mentioned. One of my other co-founders, Tom, who founded Feedback Farms, was experiencing how difficult access to market was when Feedback Farms literally neighbors restaurants. And in a large part, this was because Feedback couldn't match quantity demands necessarily of the local chefs, but often large distributors could just beat us in pricing. And he realized that, you know, in addition to gaining access to markets, small rural producers...
Wonderful. Okay, so you were just telling us how you came about to come up with the idea for Food Shed.
Sure. Did any of that come through, or I can just start from the beginning?
Yes, you told us that you were working with Tom at Feedback Farms, right? And
yes,
that he needed a way to market his food. So that's where we were at.
Yeah, exactly. So originally, Food Shed kind of came up as an idea for a way to him, as a way for him and the rest of us at Feedback to connect with local restaurants. And then we realized that, you know, if we were facing this issue as urban growers, it must be even more difficult for rural growers, to particularly small rural growers, to gain access to wholesale markets in New York City. And so, with my farm experience, I've also worked with a bunch of rural farms, and it has been kind of a similar issue of gaining access to markets. It's time-consuming, and it's laborious, and so that was the birth of Food Shed. That's where it came from.
Uh-huh. And how does Food Shed work? How does it do that?
Sure. So Food Shed is a B2B platform, which is a business-to-business platform, and it connects wholesale markets in New York City to small, sustainable farmers within a 250-mile radius. So right now we're in beta testing. We're still pretty new, and we're working exclusively with restaurants, but the idea is to expand to larger wholesale markets like institutional buyers and schools and supermarkets. And the way that the platform actually works is it has a really clean user interface. You can download the app on the App Store, and farmers have, they see one side of the platform, and buyers see another side of the platform. So a buyer would create a profile, and it really consists of just their email, their phone number, restaurant name, and address. And then once they've plugged in that information, they can see a list of local produce that's been put up by farmers within a 250-mile radius of New York City. And then on the other end of that, the farmer, they create a similar style profile where they upload their inventory, and they can set all of the details. So they can set their own prices, they can set their lead times, they can set delivery dates. And when buyers place an order, a farmer will get a notification, and the farmer can choose to accept or decline that order, and then a buyer is notified when their order has been accepted. And then FoodShed kind of sees all this information on the back end, and we deal with communication between both sides as well as delivery.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about, the delivery, because that's the part that I think would really stump most farmers who need to be working on the farm, you know, especially within 250-mile radius of New York City. You know, they can't necessarily take a whole day to drive down to deliver a case of something, right? So so does FoodShed have a truck where you pick it up and you do the delivery so that you're picking up from many different farms, or how does that work?
Yes. So right now, so we're doing all the distribution. And so because we can see all of the orders that come in, we're able to route the orders efficiently. And so we pick up from all the farms, and then we organize the orders, and we drop them off to the restaurants. Because as you had mentioned, logistics, not only is it a nightmare, but it's also really time-consuming, and you know, farming is a really labor-intensive job, and people don't have time to, you know, to leave the farm and drive, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours to New York City to make a couple of deliveries and then drive back, because it's not only a waste of time, but also it's often not cost-efficient.
So how does FoodShed make money?
So the way that FoodShed makes money is we charge farmers a 15% delivery fee. And then the platform otherwise is free. So for both buyers and farmers to download and to use the platform, it's free, but we charge farmers for delivery. And then all costs are included for the buyer. So the price that they see on all of the products that they're buying, the produce, the value-added products, all of the fees of delivery are included in that, so there's no external fees for anyone.
Uh-huh. Well, it sounds great. And so is there any qualifications that farmers need to meet or restaurants need to meet in order to create a profile?
So for restaurants, as I was saying, right now we're in beta, so we're working with only a handful of restaurants. But as long as they complete a profile that has, you know, the relevant information, and we can get, you know, we can confirm that they are a real restaurant in New York City, that's really all it is. And most restaurants that we are working with are interested in supporting sustainable local farms, not only because they think it's important, but also because they know that the produce that they're getting is that much fresher and that much tastier. And for farmers, right now, the farmers on the platform are either certified organic, or they're following organic practices but aren't yet certified, or they are natural certified, or they use sustainable practices like integrated pest management. And every farm that is on the platform, someone from FoodShed has actually gone to meet with the farmer and see how the farm is working, because part of FoodShed's mission is to connect consumers to local food. And we know that, you know, in some ways that is a luxury, because not everyone has the time and the ability to, you know, to talk to every farmer and to know exactly where everything is coming from. And so we're kind of doing that for everyone, and we're making sure that all farmers on the platform do meet certain sustainability standards.
Mm-hmm. And are you only available to New York City restaurants, or do you also serve Westchester and Long Island? And because I would assume some of the farms that you go to are out on Long Island and up in the Hudson Valley and stuff as well.
So right now, the only market that we're serving is New York City, because as I was saying, we are in beta, but we are looking to expand, and we have talked to some restaurant owners and some chefs who are based in upstate New York or in Long Island who are interested in using FoodShed and, you know, the the distribution piece there is so much smaller because the farms are that much closer.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so right now, where is Food Shed located? Are you working out of the farm?
So I'm based in New York City. We have two full-time farmers on the team, actually one of whom is based in Long Island, out in Amagansett. And we're also in discussion with a supermarket chain in the Midwest who's looking to branch out and have most of their produce, if not all of their produce, actually come from all local producers.
Mm-hmm. So I assume you or Tom or someone that you work with came up with the technology for this. Can you share with us a little bit of the role that the technology plays in Food Shed?
Sure. So Food Shed is a technology-based platform, and we're using technology to make the Food Shed more efficient and to enhance traceability for farmers and for buyers, because a big question that we've been asking is how can we make efficiencies happen in the food chain and get money into the hands of the people who deserve it, like the farmers. So we're looking to cut costs that don't help the farmers, and we're using technology to do that. And if you actually, I'm going to talk about the U.S. food dollar for a second, which the USDA defines as a $1 expenditure on domestically produced food by U.S. consumers. And in 2015, I think it was under 16 cents of the dollar went to the farmer. And then the rest of that money, the rest of that dollar, which is about 85 cents, went to marketing and distribution, which is extremely inefficient. And so at Food Shed, we're trying to figure out how we can allow small-scale farmers, to enter the market. And so one piece of technology that we're using, which I'll talk about briefly because I am by no means an expert on, is blockchain. And we're using blockchain to enable small-scale farmers to be able to plug into the larger food chain and to guarantee transparency and traceability and just general access. And a big part of that is also food safety because technology makes things easier to trace. And so,
what is blockchain? What is it? I assume that's a term that people know, but I don't. So can you share with us? I'm assuming other listeners don't know either.
Yeah, so I am not a blockchain expert, so I will give you, my simplified version of blockchain. But blockchain is essentially a ledger that allows you to see the steps. I'm trying to think of the easiest way to explain this because it's really complicated, that essentially locks in the steps that a product has taken to get to where it is. And so once it's been placed in that ledger, it can't be changed. No one can go back in and say, oh, actually, it was delivered on Tuesday, not Wednesday. Once it has been confirmed that it was delivered on Wednesday, it's stuck there for everyone to see. And so by integrating blockchain, we can make the traceability and the transparency of the food system through these small-scale farmers much more transparent and easily traceable. And so an example of where something like this could be especially useful is if there were any outbreaks of disease, or like if E. coli were to come out of a restaurant, you can easily trace back, okay, it came from this day, and we got produce from these four farms. We got spinach from these four farms, and you can easily trace back all of the steps to where the food had come from and kind of hone in on those issues where otherwise it's kind of a hidden mess, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. And when did you start Food Shed? How long has it been up and running?
Food Shed has been up and running for just over a year now, but I would say that most of that year has been used towards making the technology better and creating the product, and we've been doing deliveries now for just about 2 months.
Uh-huh. So it's really, really a startup.
Yes.
I met you, just so people know, the way I found out about Food Shed was up at the NOFA conference. I met Jesse up there and one of her other worker partners, Frank, who is also involved in the organization. I didn't meet Tom, but how big is the team that you work with right now?
Sure. So the team is about 6 people. We have 2 full-time farmers. Frank is actually one of them, and he's in Amagansett. And then we have 2 people working on development, Cecilia and John. And then there's me and Tom. And then we also have Nate and Dan. So that's more than 6, actually. But it's a nice, tight, small team.
It's a great idea. You know, I really, you know, wish you guys the best of luck. It seems like, you know, you're really meeting a need that has to happen, you know, because there's so many small farmers that would love to get their food to market and don't know how and don't have the time to sit at a farmer's market all day on the weekend. They need to be out there working. So this is really nice. Now, you say you actually, the farmers actually sell to the restaurants at wholesale price, or is the price a little bit higher?
So farmers are actually able to sell, to set their own prices with Food Shed. Mm-hmm. And so we're working with a variety of farmers right now, some of whom are selling the same products, and they're able to all set their own prices.
What do you see as some of the biggest challenges within the local food distribution?
I think that there are a lot of challenges within local food distribution. So right now, the way that legacy food distribution works is that it's not set up at all for small-scale producers because it's all a matter of scale, which means that these small-scale producers, you know, don't even have access to this market oftentimes. And I think that there's just no infrastructure really for integrating small producers into the distribution system, and that's something that we're trying to change because we're trying to fight against these economies of scale, you know, that prevent small scale distributors from entering the market. And so something that we're working on to help with that is we are aggregating products that are grown under the same growing standard. So if a wholesale buyer needs 30 pounds of lettuce and a small-scale producer, they can't supply that, we are able to source from, 2 or 3 or 4 organic growers that all have, the same type of lettuce, which is something that has been helpful in providing access to market. And I think another
isn't that a problem sometimes because the prices that different farmers might be asking is different, or do you negotiate with the farmers to try to, sell it at the same price so that you can do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, for instance, a lot of farmers have pricing information and have pricing knowledge, and so when there is a price discrepancy, it's usually very small. So, if farmers are selling organic lettuce from the Hudson Valley, usually they're selling it for a pretty similar price. But for the buyer, we create kind of like an average price of what the farmers are selling for.
Right, right. Because I know when I go to the farmer's market, there's one person might be selling organic tomatoes for $2.99 a pound, another one for $3.99, another one for $4.99. So there is a variety sometimes amongst what farmers are asking, and it could have to do with, the size of that farm and their scale and how much they grow.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think sometimes that, there is still that discrepancy even in wholesale, but there's a little bit more wiggle room, I would say, in the wholesale market.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit about the farm you're working on right now, Feedback Farm in Bushwick?
Sure. So Feedback Farms is actually located on Doe Fund property, and the Doe Fund is an organization for men who are previously incarcerated or convicted or homeless, and they do a lot of vocational training. And so Feedback is located on their property, and the majority of our produce actually goes to their kitchen, and we do a bunch of workshops there that are open to the community and are also open to residents of the Doe Fund. Yeah, we're actually just starting our new season now, and are still working collaboratively with the Doe Fund.
Mm-hmm. So that farm doesn't have like their own CSA or farmers market or anything that you participate in?
So we don't have a CSA, but we do. Last summer we participated in. in a local farmers market that was geared towards education and food access. So we would harvest produce and we would bring it to, I think, just two or three blocks away to the farmers market and sell there. Otherwise, mm-hmm. I would say about 50% of our produce went to the Doe Fund kitchen. And then the rest of it was split between the farmers market and a few local restaurants.
Uh-huh. Okay, so, and which farmer's market is that that you participate in?
I'm actually not sure of the name. One of my coworkers was actually in charge of the market, but I can look it up and get that information to you.
Okay, and when you do, I'll share it. You don't have to do it
sure.
now, but I'll share it. Does that farm grow a variety, and are you only growing vegetables, or do you also have chickens or bees and stuff like that?
So the farm plot is pretty small, and it's often used as an educational plot. It actually started as a research-based farm plot. Tom, one of the founders of Feedback Farms, was creating these sub-irrigated beds, and they did a couple of research projects with it. But the farm itself is pretty small. And we don't have space for chickens, unfortunately, but we do grow a variety of vegetables. And last year we were growing zucchini and eggplant and kale, tomatoes, a variety of things, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So since Food Shed started, what kind of responses have you been getting from consumers and restaurants?
Yeah, we've been getting a really positive response from consumers because I think most people want to be supporting local agriculture and sustainable agriculture, but it oftentimes comes as either like a luxury or a burden. And so we're kind of working to create a way where they can support these farms and these growers in a way that's convenient for them. And I think that has gotten a really positive response.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And what kind of future plans do you have for Food Shed? Are you looking to expand? I'm sure you are, but what is your, projection?
Yeah. So as I said before, we're still in beta and we're looking to expand to larger wholesale clients. But we're also looking to get into seconds, or otherwise known as a kind of ugly produce for value-added producers,
mm-hmm.
Who, jams and sauces. And we're also interested in connecting food that has no home and would otherwise be, would be composted or maybe just given away at a discount price to food pantries and other emergency food kitchens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of other organizations I'm sure you're aware of doing some of that, like Ample Harvest,
mm-hmm.
Collecting
yeah.
from local home growers, really,
mm-hmm.
and donating that extra produce to food pantries and stuff.
Yeah, it's a great project.
Yeah, so that's a really nice thing. Well, that's wonderful. So does the farm that you're working at, Feedback Farm, you say you have the volunteers that are from the Doe Fund organization working on the farm with you. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so we have a variety. We have people who are part of the GoFund program who work on the farm, and then we also have had some other volunteers work on the farm as well who are not a part of the program. And then we
Do you do any type of workshops with them to teach them how to cook the food? Because that's always one of the things that I guess I'm so involved in. People buy all this beautiful produce, and then they don't really know what to do with it. Do you assist in that at all?
Yeah, so we actually were having weekly workshops on Sunday evenings, where we would have kind of a gardening workshop and then also either a cooking or nutritional workshop. And that was something that we talked about with different foods and how to cook them, because I think, there was also a variety of foods that people had never seen before. And so we would cook them there. We actually had a grill that we could use. And so we could do some small cooking workshops.
Mm-hmm. And as part of the Food Shed platform, is there a way for restaurants to request certain items they're looking for to try to encourage a farm, let's say, to grow something that, might not be as widespread here, whether it's, jicama or, something that's not as familiar here? Can they have specialty requests?
Yes. We've actually had some chefs already request certain specialty items. And so we have told certain farmers that this is what chefs are interested in, and then it's their choice if they're looking to grow that or not.
Well, that's great. So we're just about out of time, Jesse. Can you share with my listeners how they would find out more information about Food Shed and maybe a contact for you if they have any questions?
Sure. So if you're interested in learning more about Food Shed, you can go to foodshed.io. That's our web address. And if you have any questions for me, you can email me at Jessie, J-E-S-S-I-E, at foodshed.io.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining me, and I wish you guys the best of luck. I think it's a great, exciting new project, and we need this kind of innovation to really get to really help our farmers and our restaurants provide more local food, and it's good for the local economy. So just really great all the way around. So I really wish you guys the best of luck.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And everybody listening, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. See you all again next week. Bye for now.